www.ncbc.org.
Having a heat wave, a tropical heat wave.
Hey, Lori.
Hey, Linda.
Hey, we're the Lulus from Tuesday Traffic Jam. WMNF's tropical heat wave is coming to the Cuban Club in Ybor City, May 4th. And we don't want you to miss this night. 16 bands, including the sensational Barnes Brothers, Eddie 9V, Ruthie Foster, The Record Company, and Say She She.
In the Cantina, you can see Christopher James Band, Selwyn Birchwood, The Dolly Rots, Sweeping Promises, and Tiger 54.
Stop by the theater for the hip-hop experience.
Dance in the ballroom with the Real Class, Black Valley Moon, Divine AF, Soul Purpose 4, North Star, and Wah! World Fusion. Go to tropicalheatwave.org for tickets or for further information, call 813-238-8001. See you at the heat wave.
Having a heat wave, a tropical heat wave.
Good morning and welcome to True Talk. This is your host, Samar Jarrah. Today is Thursday, another beautiful day in Florida and a very strange day in America, because I hope you're following the news, but it seems that freedom of speech is limited and not as prevalent as we thought. You can have free speech as long as it's not about Palestine. Listen to this music. I have interesting show for you today. I hope I can get all the people I want to get, because everybody is either on campus or trying to go to campus from the people I wanted to interview. But I am hoping to talk with James Bamford about AI that is being used in the war machine and the killing machine in Gaza. I hope he can make it. He's outside the country. And I am hoping when you listen to what he has to say, because it's truly scary, maybe you will understand why these students are really demonstrating for Palestine. Listen to this lovely music from Africa. This is True Talk on WMF.
Mwen plezi, mwen bel glo, bel piedwa, yo ka fleri. Mwen la nati, mwen Jack Sekob, agre goudé, mwen tout ça, ke j'ai mwen wè, ke m'ba toune, oh, pou te bok, ke ou pou reme, ki te reme,
ewa,
ke se wale, ki te lme, non pa trompe ou chime,
ewa,
nou se teye, nou se proche mwen, nou se proche,
ewa.
And welcome back to True Talk. As promised, alhamdulillah, I have James Bamford with me on the phone. And James is a filmmaker at PBS and a former writer at Foreign Policy. He's the author of Spy Fail, the Puzzle Palace, Body of Secrets, The Shadow Factory. Today we're going to be talking with James about quite a disturbing article that he has written on April 12 and published in The Nation magazine. And let me read just the title of this piece. I hope you can go to The Nation magazine and read what James writes about. The title is How U.S. Intelligence and an American Company Feed Israel's Killing Machine in Gaza. Because it's not so much the bombs that kill, but the list that puts civilians in the way of the bombs. I'm so happy to be talking to you, James. Good morning, maybe not morning in where you are now. I can't hear you, James. James?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you now.
Okay.
Yeah, I can hear you. I was just reading the title of your disturbing piece, actually, how U.S. intelligence and American company feed Israel's killing machine in Gaza, especially watching what is going on at the moment in U.S. campuses and colleges. And maybe they have read your piece, James, because you published it April 12 and all this started in the colleges before that. But before we begin, maybe our listeners, some of them might not know, what is AI? What is artificial intelligence? Can you explain it to us, please?
Well, it's basically an advanced system of technology where you're basically letting computers or robots take over, where people used to do their own thinking or making their own decisions. They've advanced computers far enough so that the computers actually take the place of somebody's brain or somebody's thinking at the time. So instead of five people getting around and deciding whether they're going to target a particular building or a house or a person with a weapon and making a lot of calculations and making a lot of decisions, that's all left to a computer, basically an AI system. And so the where the people may take 20 minutes or an hour or 5 hours to decide whether to launch an attack or a weapon, computer or the AI software system and computer can do it in a matter of seconds or minutes. So that's the difference between just normal activity and using AI.
So how did you become interested in this topic? How did you end up writing about this particular American company, this project? I mean, do you have background in studying AI, or could you tell our listeners how you became interested in this topic? Because I swear to God, it's the most disturbing article I have read in the past few weeks.
I graduated from law school and was interested in becoming a writer. So nobody had ever done a book on the National Security Agency, the NSA. It's the most secret agency in the U.S., but it's also the most highly technical, advanced technological spy agency in the world. So I've written three books about the NSA, and I'm largely an expert on the technical side of intelligence. So that's pretty much how I've gotten into it. Since then, I've done a number of documentaries for PBS and on this topic, and we're on electronic spying and advanced eavesdropping and so forth, and written numerous articles. And so that's sort of my background.
Okay, you start the article by talking about a certain unit called 8200, which specializes in eavesdropping, code breaking, and cyber warfare in Israel, which, like you just mentioned, your interest in the American National Security Agency. Now, what is this unit doing in particular, and how it is using American AI and information?
Well, in the United States, the most advanced technological intelligence agency is the NSA, the National Security Agency. And in Israel, their equivalent of the NSA, they're equal to the NSA, is called Unit 8200. And that's their advanced spying agency, technological intelligence agency. And the two agencies in the two countries, United States and Israel, and the NSA and Unit 8200 have had extremely close relationships for decades. And it's all part of a written agreement, very secret agreement between the two. And what the Israelis need from the United States is data. In other words, information on Palestinians living in the occupied territories and so forth. So NSA is able to eavesdrop on communications between Palestinians in the United States and their relatives or friends in the occupied territory. So NSA eavesdrops on those communications, intercepts them secretly, and then passes that information on to the Israelis. As in addition, they assist the Israelis on eavesdropping on the occupied territory. So all that information is passed on to Unit 8200 from the NSA. And then you and
okay, James.
In God, years ago.
Yeah, I think we kind of got lost you with the internet. I'm not sure it's my end or you. Yeah, maybe yes. If you remove the camera, James, are you back?
Yeah, I think. Yeah, I can hear.
Yeah, I can hear you better without the camera.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So anyway, so there's this great deal of sharing. The NSA gives Unit 8200 a lot of private and confidential information about Palestinians in the United States, their communications, their telephone calls, emails, and so forth. Passes it on to Israel. Israel uses it to target Palestinians in the occupied territory. So that's been going on a long time, and at one point it got so bad that even the Israelis military, who was working for Unit 8200, was so disgusted by it, they actually walked out, over 40 of them, and held a press conference saying this is outrageous what we're doing. So that's sort of the background before the whole war in Gaza, and it's probably increased a great deal since then.
But James, I'm really baffled by the information you're telling me, because I have many friends here who have family in the West Bank. Very few have family in Gaza. And all these friends of mine are women. What on earth are they spying on? I mean, are all Palestinian American suspect, or are dealing with Hamas, or dealing with armed groups? I mean, the information they are getting, 99% probably, is just they're just women talking about food and children and mothers-in-law. James?
Well, yeah, they're getting. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can.
Yeah, I'm having trouble with this audio here for some reason.
Okay.
Well, the NSA eavesdrops on these people because they're communicating with people in Israel. There's no other reason for it. That's what they were doing in the past, and I assume that's what they're doing today. There's a law in the United States that if you're eavesdropping on a U.S. Citizen in the United States, you need a warrant to do that. Mm-hmm. But if the person's communicating with a foreigner in a foreign country, the NSA doesn't need a warrant. It could just eavesdrop on the person. So that's what they do. And they pass that on to the Israelis, and the Israelis are happy to get it because then they consider that intelligence on people living in the occupied territories and so forth.
Can we talk about the Planter company? You talk extensively.
Yeah. There's a number of companies that actually help the Israelis, and Palantir is one of them. And that's a very big, very successful company for selling targeting software and data mining. So NSA sends all this data to the Israelis, but somebody has to go through it. And that's where this AI, some people call it autonomous intelligence, is useful. And that's where that's what they get from Palantir, is this targeting software. And the software that goes through all the data that the Israelis acquire, that unity. To make sense.
I think you mentioned that all this data goes to Unit 8200.
That's of it.
Yeah, because we keep losing
technology.
You, James. I'm not sure if it's your mic or it's your internet connection.
Yeah, maybe both. I'm sorry, I have no idea. It usually works really well.
I hope they're not spying on you. After you wrote this article, maybe
I'm probably a key target. But anyway, while we have the internet connection here, the company supplies the software in order to go through all the data that's supplied to the Israelis, and then the Israelis use this software from Palantir to target people, homes, families, businesses, buildings in Gaza.
Let me just mention to our listeners that we're talking to James Bamford. He's an author and a researcher. He wrote for the Foreign Policy, and he has written a very disturbing article published April 12, in The Nation magazine, and it's called How U.S. Intelligence and the American Company Feed Israel's Killing Machine, and he just named the name of the company, and for some weird reason, he is having technical issues with his internet. I want to go back to the article, James, and I think the co-founder and CEO of the company, you said, is Alex Karp, and he said, our product, I'm quoting, our product is used on occasion to kill people. And he says, I have asked myself, if I were younger at college, would I be protesting me? Unbelievable that you have this quote, James, in the article, in the midst of what is happening in U.S. colleges. So how can these CEOs live with themselves seeing the carnage? Because how do they know if the target is a civilian or not? If there are moms, if there are kids. I mean, more than half of who have been killed are women and children. How is this possible?
Yes. Well, the decisions are made by Israel to, according to one of their policies, is that they target particular individuals, and then it's fairly difficult for them to target them while they're in a car. Or one of the programs that they have tell you basically, and see the people that are come up with the targets, that their target is at home. So once they're at home, it's easy to attack them because they're not going anywhere. They're just there, and they could target the home. The problem is that when they target the home, they're killing everybody. They're killing the wife and the children and grandparents, whoever happens to be in the house. So, yeah, I agree. I don't know how they can live with themselves, but they apparently do. And there's no question that
But
the majority of the people that are killed are women, children, civilians.
Because Gaza, I'm sure you know, is very densely populated, and it's not like they're living in a villa or in a standing house where, okay, just the family of this guy would be killed. They're usually in buildings, and the whole, like the aunts and the uncles and the sisters-in-law and a million children live in one building. So can they just target an apartment in a building, or they just blow up the whole building? And that's why we have so much death toll.
Well, I think they end up a lot of times blowing up the whole building because they to actually send a rocket through a particular window of a particular apartment is fairly difficult. So, and I don't think they care much about killing civilians. It's certainly shows that in the past. So then, as a result of that, they have a missile that will hit the building and end up killing most of the people in there. I mean, that's how you just take a look at Gaza. You can see the enormous amounts of destruction there. It's not as though they're being very sterile in terms of where they're aiming their rockets. They're blasting everything up. So when the targeting, when they do their targeting, they're targeting a home or apartment building, wherever they target be, and they are killing innocent civilians. And that's, I've been writing numerous articles, but
okay, how
the horrendous. What
is the error margin? Like, how accurate is this information and this technology?
Well, the technology is very good in terms of putting a missile in the right location to kill the people. The problem is that how are they deciding who's a valid target and who isn't? How are they deciding who's a member of Hamas and who isn't? And it seems very random. I mean, they're you know, these are not isolated targets. They're targeting everybody. You've got over 33,000 people that are known dead. You know, you don't know how many are buried under the rubble and so forth. So it's this indiscriminate bombing, indiscriminate missile attacks, indiscriminate killing that's been going on. And that's one of the reasons I wrote the article, was to show how this is taking place. It's taking place because they're putting targets on almost everybody's back.
Using an American technology and company. So when these students are saying the U.S. is complicit in the genocide going on in Gaza, they only have to read your article and read about the company and read what the CEO has said himself. And now you are, according to your interesting article, you say that they are even doing a different system called Titan. Can you?
Well, it's a brand new system. They haven't marketed it yet. But the problem is when you have, when these defense companies, weapons companies and so forth, when they're developing a new system, they don't know how well it'll work. And so a lot of times they'll test these systems in a war zone. Mm. And the company is developing targeting both in Ukraine and in Gaza and the possibly the West Bank. So they have a lot of potential for testing out this new system. They could test it out in Ukraine, or they could test it out in Israel, or they could test it out in both places. So it's in development, and that's the problem. It's being developed right now. And since it's before the time when they're going to sell it, it's the time when they're going to test it, and they may test it on human beings in Gaza and in Ukraine.
I can't believe what I am hearing here. Gaza is the testing field for all the Western bombs and weapons and now technology. You also talk about in your article about an investigation that was done by 972 Plus magazine. And you mentioned something called Lavender. There is a system called Lavender. What is that?
Lavender is again, it's another targeting system. I don't know if it's connected to the particular American company, but it's an Israeli AI system, and it's used to again target individuals. And part of what Lavender does is it basically puts a target on the back of whoever they're after, so that the system will keep track of the person wherever they are, and then they have a second system that once the person's in their house, that's when they launch the weapons on the person. So lavender is used in the same way as the other targeting systems. What Pelletier does mostly is sift through the data to help the targeters place the weapons where they want to go. And Lavender is a system for getting those weapons there very quickly without much analysis.
So how long does it take? Like minutes, hours, days, seconds to make a decision to send the bomb or the missile?
Well, there's one person I quote from. He was in, he visited the company's office in London, I think it was last year. And he was astounded because he said that normally it would take hours to make a targeting decision, you know, who to target or what building to target. And he said now they're able to do it just in a few minutes. And so it's gone from hours down to just a couple of minutes. Because that's the whole idea of autonomous systems, is that they make the decisions instead of the people.
Do you think the bombing of the convoy and the aid vehicles belonging to World Central Kitchen was due to an error of one of these AI systems?
Well, that's what I wrote about in the article there. It was, on the one hand, the companies and the Israelis are saying their systems are so accurate, they're you know, extremely accurate because they use AI. On the other hand, if they're so accurate, then how can you say that it was a mistake that you blew up three aid vehicles? And not only did they blow them up, I mean, the missiles hit directly into the roof of the different vehicles, and on that roof was painted the logos for the aid company. So so to me, it was a deliberate attack. You can't make a mistake like that. Not three vehicles in a row, all directly targeted.
Why would they do that to a very well-respected, known aid agency or entity, which, as you have seen, really created an uproar? Of course, they forgot all about it now after Israel bombing the embassy in Syria and then Iran retaliating. But why would they target such a very well-known target?
Well, it's the same reason that they've been denying food trucks and aid trucks into the into Gaza. The whole idea is to starve the population, they've been holding up aid trucks so they don't get in. They're using food as a weapon. So that's sort of what would go against their policy if they're trying to if their policy is to starve the people of Gaza to death. They use food as a weapon. Then if somebody's actually delivering food to them, they look at that as basically a weapon or whatever. So that's why they would target it. They claim that it was a mistake, that it was an error, and they fired a few people. Mm-hmm. But you don't make mistakes like that. That's too. It was just something that you can't make a mistake on. These trucks were very well painted. Everybody knew that they were going from point A to point B. They were in a convoy. So, as far as I'm concerned, it was deliberate. And the reason it was deliberate was to, again, keep the food from getting to the people who are starving.
I want to read a quote because it's another disturbing quote, and because I want to ask you actually, maybe before I read that disturbing quote, do other countries have this technology, like in Europe or China or Russia or India? Do you know if other countries have this technology?
These other countries are developing AI software. How far they've developed it, I'm not sure. It's something that these countries try to keep very secret. Mm-hmm. But China and Russia are both extremely advanced when it comes to weapons of war and so forth. And Russia's been involved in a war now for over 2 years. Mm-hmm. So they're obviously trying to get on the fast track for developing systems like the ones we're talking about here. And China is extremely high tech. It's an enormously high tech company. I mean, they're putting people in space, they're building a space station, they want to put people on the moon. They've got enormous technological capabilities, and so they probably have a very similar system. So that's where the whole world is moving. It's moving towards an AI, sort of an AI world where, you know, we've gone from digital to everybody having their own computer, everybody having their own cell phone, and we keep moving further and further into technology, and now the next move is to create a system so that the machines make the decisions and the machines take over in terms of targeting and killing people.
The reason I asked you this question is because I'm going to read this quote from your article, which says that's according to Palantir, I don't know how to pronounce it.
Palantir,
CEO Alex Karp, that he says, and I'm quoting, "The power of advanced algorithmic warfare system is now so great that it equates to having tactical nuclear weapons against an adversary with only conventional ones." Isn't this scary?
Well, sure, yeah, and that's coming from the person who certainly knows what he's talking about. Yeah. He's the president of the company. That's a very efficient way of saying how powerful it is. He's comparing it to the
nuclear sort of weapons,
computer equivalent of a nuclear weapon, or a targeting equivalent of a nuclear weapon. So that a nuclear weapon is designed to kill a lot of people. And that's what these systems are designed to do. A nuclear weapon does it on a massive scale. And then, again, that's what these systems are designed to do.
Very quickly, before we wrap up, James, how was the reaction to the article?
Well, it was very good. I've done quite a few interviews. I was on Democracy Now! On Monday and doing other interviews. So it's, it's gotten a lot of attention. I've been writing about these things for a long time. So it's gotten a lot of attention, this topic, all of a sudden, because of, how it's, before it was mostly theoretical, and now you can see the end result. All these people get killed. So that's why it's become such a important topic today.
I want to just ask you, I know maybe you're not even in the country at the moment, but these students obviously do read, the ones who are demonstrating for Palestine, to end the genocide, to divest from Israel, and these companies, because they want American companies, probably like this one, to divest from Israel and to stop giving this technology to Israel. You think they read they obviously read. They're not anti-Semitic as our media is trying to label them. What do you think, James, of what is happening on U.S. campuses?
Well, I've written quite a bit about that. I wrote quite a bit about it in my previous book, came out last year, Spy Fail, about how Israel is using a lot of techniques to get to these students on the campuses. And the U.S. government's never done anything about that. Things called Canary Mission, for example, where they target, put these people on
website and with their address and faces, I think.
Yeah, they tried to intimidate them from speaking out against what's going on in between Israel and the Palestinians. So that's been going on for years, and nobody did anything about that. I wrote a whole article about that for The Nation. And, you know, these are that's a very dangerous thing, because if you start a computer program and all you're doing is putting names of people who are students and slandering them and so forth, it makes it very hard for them to ever get a job. So this has been going on for a long time, and nobody's done anything about it. Now all of a sudden, there's all this outrage because some of these students are demonstrating. And so I'm all for them demonstrating, because the government has done nothing about how they've been targeted by the pro-Israeli forces for years before now.
I want to thank you, James Bamford, for being on True Talk. He wrote a very wonderful, disturbing piece called How U.S. Intelligence and an American Company Feed Israel's Killing Machine in Gaza. You can find it on The Nation magazine, and you can Google James Bamford, B-A-M-F-O-R-D, and read more of his amazing pieces. I want to thank you so much, James, for taking the time and talking to us.
Oh, my pleasure. Well, thanks for having me on your show. And, I just hope that people come to their senses and we get out of this illegal and terrible war very quickly.
Thank you so much, James. I hope so, too. I'm going to take a very short break because I am hoping to get somebody who is at one of the campuses in the U.S. And talk to us. It has been so difficult to reach the students because, you know, their lives are being threatened, unfortunately. I have no idea what you think, all of you, of what you are seeing. Of course, you are only seeing one slanted explanation of what is going on in the U.S. campuses. You know, I've lived here for 43 years and I thought I saw it all, especially with Trump and now Biden and Trump and the election and these two guys only being the only choices we have as future presidents. But really, I never thought I will see an uprising in U.S. colleges. But maybe they were reading this article. Really, I'm very, very curious to hear what you think. You can send your messages, your emails to dj@wmnf.org. I can open also the phone lines, 813-239-9663. But let me try with this person who is at the moment at one of the campuses and see if she can talk to us. I hope she can. This is WMNF Tampa. I'm going to be right back.
Mwen men plezi, mwen men bel glo, bel piedwa, yo ka fleri. Mwen men la nati, men jak sinkob, ak de goudé, mwen men. Mwen men tout sa, ke jè mwen wè, ke mba toune, oh. Pou jè bok, ke ou pou reme, ki tel reme.
Ewa.
Kè se wale, ki tel me, nou pa pompe ou chime.
Ewa.
Nou se teye, nou se pochme, nou se poche.
Ewa.
Aimer, on nous aimer, on dit, hey, Haïti,
Okay, welcome back to True Talk. I'm so happy that I have Dima Al-Khatib on the phone. She is a Palestinian journalist and with AJ Plus. Dima, what is going on? I think you just arrived to the U.S. and you are in shock of what you're witnessing. Please tell us what is going on and where are you now?
Yes, of course. I came to the U.S. for the first time since the beginning of the genocide. 6 months covering the genocide day in, day out. It is very depressing. Obviously, all of us seeing those images every day and seeing that the world was doing nothing about it. Rather, the world was supporting the genocidal perpetrators of this humanity, crime against humanity. And then I got to Boston and met with the students at Harvard, at Tufts, and it was just incredible. I found them not only aware of everything that's happening, but rather representing a new hope for a different future, a different tomorrow that they will lead, knowing that the conversation did not start on the 7th of October, knowing that it started back in 1948. The students surprised me. The vocabulary they use is ethnic cleansing, genocide, apartheid, occupation, settler colonialism, all the terminology and the lexicon that we've been fighting so the world would acknowledge that this is what's happening in Palestine. They say Palestine. They don't say Palestinian territory. They say occupation. They say all the right words, and they're very passionate. What's really surprising for me is the Jewish community that is within those encampments. They're very vocal about how they feel. And some of them come from Zionist families, and that's why they're actually hiding their identities, because they don't want to be reprimanded by their own families. And they come from rich families, and that's the interesting part as well. So they come from wealthy, rich America. In very expensive and very important universities in America. This is incredible, Sama. It's a huge shift, huge.
Dima, the way our media and people in power and the elites in the U.S. are framing this as if it's an anti-Semitic movement spreading in the USA on campuses, and this is why they really have to call the National Guards, and this is why they have to call the police, and this is why they have to use maybe violence, like as if they are setting the stage to use violence. So don't say anything, because we are fighting hate and we are fighting anti-Semitism. What did you sense that in the campuses that you visited?
I asked them about this, and obviously their answer is very easy. We're Jewish. How can they call us anti-Semitic? They cannot. So for them, it's very clear. I didn't see anything anti-Semitic myself. Of course, that depends on what is the interpretation of anti-Semitism, because it's been weaponized by Israel for many years to get sympathy and to play always the victim card. So for many people that I know, just the slogan "From the River to the Sea" is anti-Semitic, or the word Palestine. I was told the fact that I'm Palestinian is anti-Semitic, and that's ridiculous. That's actually going very far and really changing the meaning of anti-Semitism. Because when we say "From the River to the Sea," and actually this is something many Israelis say as well, we mean liberty, freedom, equal rights for Palestinians and others across from the river to the sea who are indigenous to the land, because there are Jews who are indigenous to the land. And I know many who call for the same thing, and they don't consider "from the river to the sea" an anti-Semitic slogan. So this is up for interpretation, but honestly, these people are peaceful. They're beautiful. There's Christians, there's Muslims, there's Jews. They've been celebrating each other's cultures, different cultures, and protecting them each other. So I saw, for example, yesterday here in Ann Arbor, on campus, it's a huge camp, by the way, I saw them protecting the Muslim prayers, because the police is around, is encircling the encampment. They celebrated Jewish, I'm not sure how it's pronounced, just 2 days ago.
Cedar, I think.
Right, Peter. they celebrated, and the Muslim community of at the Intan encampment celebrated with them. It's a beautiful community, and it's a model for coexistence, something that I'm sure is possible everywhere around the world if people just listen to each other, like these people are listening to each other and doing this. And I have to say, and I found that this awareness is deep-rooted. So the organizations that are organizing this have been doing divestment campaigns for a very long time. I was told here in Ann Arbor that they started in 2000. Can you imagine? In the year 2000. And they call the body that organizes the encampment in Ann Arbor at the University of Michigan the Tahrir Coalition, which made me think of Tahrir Square in Cairo. And I was there during the Egyptian Revolution. And it does feel a little bit like Tahrir Square on campus in Ann Arbor. It's a very beautiful sense of belonging to a cause that we all agree with and that is for a better future for humanity, not just for Palestinians. It's way off, you know, far off of what is being said about these encampments being anti-Semitic. This is just weaponization, the usual weaponization
of
against anybody who says anything against Israel.
Let me just remind our listeners that are listening to True Talk on WMNF 88.5 FM. I am Samar Jarrah and I'm talking to Dima Al-Khatib, who is a Palestinian journalist and is visiting the U.S. and the campuses. She's at Ann Arbor. Now, Dima, where do these kids get their information? Because I'm sure you're following our local U.S. news. The Congress is giving TikTok 1 year to sell their shares in the U.S. or they will ban it. So where do, and I'm sure these students are not listening to our mainstream media because then they would start hating themselves. But where do you think, where did you sense they know their information? I mean, do they go to Google? Do they meet with Palestinians? Have they visited? Like, where is all this information is coming? Like, how did they change or they were, I don't even know what to ask you anymore because I can't believe the language, like they use genocide.
Yes. They don't trust the media. They know that mainstream media is biased against social justice. They've learned this in the past from the BLM, Indigenous Movement. They know. They've been there. The trust amongst these people in mainstream media is almost zero. They rely on social media. They rely on community. They have people. I've asked the Jews who are from Zionist families how come they came about to be who they are today, thinking the way they think. And they said it's thanks to fellow students or even, college, just Palestinians or Arabs and Muslims who told them the real story. And they went online, looked it up, and it turned out to be true.
So they
also use social media a lot. TikTok has been incredible. The narrative on TikTok has just been completely pro-Palestinian. But not just on TikTok. I have to tell you, we have data that shows that across platforms, Twitter, YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, as well as TikTok, the narrative has shifted to becoming pro-Palestinian, despite all the censorship, despite the fact that they removed, they shadow banned lots of posts because of what they claim is anti-Semitic discourse or inciting violence. After removing millions of posts, the pro-Palestinian narrative is actually had more space than the pro-Israeli narrative on those platforms, but especially on TikTok, you will see that the difference between pro-Palestinian and pro-Israeli is huge. We're talking a difference in the tens of billions of views more on videos that are pro-Palestinian as opposed to pro-Israeli. Although the Israeli side, they have a financed, organized campaign that has been ongoing for decades. They, Hasbara is a machine that feeds, social media and the media with a narrative that favors Israel, but that has been defeated because, well, the people, power to the people. I think it's all the diaspora of Palestinians around the world that have kept the story alive generation after generation. You'll see them 4 generations down the line, 5 generations down the line, after their grandparents were evicted or kicked out, dispossessed from their land. They keep the narrative going, and these kids are very good at telling stories and at convincing others, as well as other communities. As I said, I mentioned BLM, I mentioned the Indigenous movement. There's lots of solidarity across the different struggles for social justice, and people see settler colonialism very clearly as being the case in Palestine, as it was here in America when the Indigenous people were dispossessed and replaced by settlers who came from far away.
Dima, what are the students going to do? Because it looks like there is going to be a standoff. I mean, when you have all these congressmen and women coming to Colombia and have the audacity and really the disconnect from reality, and to think of addressing the students and the students who were not even couldn't hear them, but they were booing them. Is like, are the students ready for a standoff with authorities? They don't fear being arrested. They don't fear being, I mean, some of them were expelled from schools, and professors have countered that by saying, we're not going to accept expelling our students, and we're going to grade them and we're going to give them grades. But what did you sense? Are they that unfearful? Are they that courageous and willing to sacrifice everything for Palestine?
You see, they don't see it as sacrificing everything for Palestine. They see themselves defending humanity and the freedom of all. And therefore, yes, they are fearful. When I ask them this, and I ask them also about how they are able to stay in the cold. I don't know if you're aware, but it's really, really cold here in Ann Arbor. It was -3. Celsius. I don't know what it is in Fahrenheit, but it's really, really cold. It's freezing. I was wearing all the clothes I have and gloves and everything. And they were sleeping in the tent. And when I asked them, aren't you, like, why would you have to do this? Why do you have to sleep in the cold like that? Don't you have warm homes and families to be with? And I asked the same question about them fearing the police coming after them, or fearing maybe sanctions from the university, being deprived even of finishing school. And they said, well, we're not, why should we feel that we are privileged to have that when the people of Gaza don't have it? The people of Gaza sleep in the cold. The people of Gaza are exposed not only to not finishing school, but also to being killed. They're exposed to being arrested, to being tortured. And we are just human beings like them. If they are exposed to that, we should stop it, because then all of us are exposed. The result of these kids is really, again, I have to say, it reminds me of Tahrir Square.
Tahrir Square in
the fearlessness of Tahrir Square.
Yeah, Tahrir Square in Egypt during these Arab Spring, just to clarify to our listeners.
Tahrir means liberation.
Liberation.
For those who don't speak Arabic, Tahrir means liberation. And that's what they were telling me yesterday. The Tahrir Coalition aims for the liberation of all, because nobody's free until everybody's free.
I want to thank you so much, Dima Al-Khatib, Palestinian journalist, for being on True Talk. I wish you well in your travels to U.S. campuses. Thank you for being on True Talk.
Thank you so much for having me.
Okay, I know there is a caller. I apologize, but we're running out of time. We're going to be talking about this next week. So whoever, I didn't take your call, please call next week. And those who send the emails, we're going to be talking about this next week. You see what happened to U.S. colleges. So we have to make sure we keep WMNF, so keep supporting WMNF. WMNF Tampa, The Scoop is next.